Dr. Lum is a consultant in diabetes and general medicine in Oxford. His other clinical interests include pancreas transplantations, inpatient diabetes, insulin pump therapy, and CGM monitoring, and the management of type 1 diabetes for sport and exercise. So a huge bag of goodies there that we'll be talking about tonight, I'm sure. Alistair is the co-chair of the Diabetes Technology Network UK, a UK organisation which provides training and representation for healthcare professionals with an interest in using technology for the management of diabetes. And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about that tonight, and especially with the hot news coming out on social media today. Alistair also wears multiple hats, including clinical lead for the Diabetes Network Inpatient Safety Audit, sits on the Diabetes UK Clinical Studies Group for acute care, and also is part of the Exercise in Type 1 Diabetes XTOD conference for healthcare professionals and people with diabetes. So tonight we'll be talking and learning lots from Alistair, talking about his career in diabetes, technology, sports and exercise, and lots of other little snippets as well. So if you want to get involved, hashtag diabetes chat, or you can request the microphone. We've got some questions from us. We've got some questions from you guys. If you want to get involved, please do, because then we'll have a great time. Alistair, welcome to Diabetes Chat. Let's hope this works now.
Yeah, hopefully. Well, thank you very much. Thanks very much for the invitation. It's a real honour to be here, actually. So, looking forward to chatting to everyone.
Brilliant. Super. So what we'll do is we're going to do our quick fire questions. And as explained to the other day when we caught up, we normally do quick fire questions to get to know the guest speaker. Primarily, we have people who have diabetes, and also we do have healthcare professionals that come on as well. So I'm going to fire some questions here, just to sort of quick answer responses. And then later on, we're obviously going to dig deeper and get to know you even more. All right. Does that sound good?
Okay. Sounds brilliant.
Super. Let's have a bit of fun. Let's get my funky sound effect, and Philippa will be happy. Are we ready? What is your name and occupation?
So, Alistair, and diabetes doctor.
If you were diabetic, what would your go-to hypo treatment? What would you go for, do you reckon?
Oh, good question. I'm thinking the jelly baby.
Yes.
If you have only been recreational for me, so it's different for me to know.
Yes. If you had a choice, do you reckon, of insulin pens or pump, what would you maybe prefer?
Really good question. I think pump, just because of the kind of flexibility that it offers and what it can do. And also, obviously, you've been talking already about the hybrid closed loops. I guess I don't know, because I've never had to wear one for an extended period of time.
So. Yeah. What do you think is worse, Alistair? Feeling hypo, low, or hyper? What would you imagine?
That's a really good question again. I think a hypo, I can see how that would be really sort of disturbing.
Yeah.
If you kind of were very low and wanted to kind of treat yourself and weren't able to, I could see that would be scary.
Absolutely.
But then people often say that feeling hyper makes them feel really cross. I guess hypo.
One thing you like about diabetes and one thing you don't like about diabetes.
One thing I like about diabetes is the people.
Yep.
That's people with diabetes and people I work with. And some of those are the same thing. What don't I like about diabetes? I think you were talking about it already. Stigma is one thing I really don't like.
Yeah. Do you have a preference towards the smell of insulin? Do you love it, hate it, indifferent? Any thought?
I'm in totally the wrong job. I can't smell ketones and I can't smell insulin.
Oh, man.
So I'm okay with this one. So I'm indifferent.
Indifferent in that one. And just to get to know you a little bit better, if you're on a desert island, the Diabetes Chat Desert Island, where all our guest speakers end up, what three things would you take? Just to get to know you.
Okay. I would take, so if I could have three things, I want books, so a Kindle
yeah
would be, you know, something like that, so I can it would be a special kind of desert island, but I like mountain biking, so maybe a bike would be good so you could explore. And I'd also, do you know what, I'd love to take my dogs. I suspect that's banned, but I'd love to take my dog.
You can take whatever you want. There you go. Kindle books. So you can have multiple books there. See what you did there. Your bike and your dogs. Love it. Absolutely love it. So there you go, guys. Just to get to know Alistair a little bit more, some fun questions. If you have any questions for Alistair throughout the duration, like I said, hashtag diabetes chat. All right. So tonight, Alistair, you've got me asking you some questions, and hopefully we'll get some questions on the community as well. I think, first of all, I think it'd be a good starting point to actually get to know you a little bit more and you to tell us, guys, a little bit about your connection to diabetes and your background in your field, I guess, and where it all really started. Like, why diabetes? What fascinated you to go down that route? Was that something you decided to study? Like, I saw doing a bit of research, is that what was part of your degrees, or please tell us a little bit.
It's a really good question. I've got to go into the dim and distant past. I worked out recently, I've been working in diabetes for 17 years now, so this is going back even before that to when I was choosing. So I think when I went to medical school, I think you found out medicine wasn't the first thing I studied. So I went to university. When I first went to university, I thought I was going to do physics. And then I did one physics experiment and it broke me. And so I needed to find something else. I ended up doing a degree which was in psychology. And then after that, did some research with young kids, so 3 and 4 year old kids. So my experiments, in inverted commas, were inventing games and then talking to nursery schools and then going into nursery schools and kind of playing the games with kids to try and sort of work out what they were thinking. And that was great fun, but I kind of decided I didn't want to do that forever. So then went to medical school, and I thought I wanted to be a paediatrician. And I am, frankly, way too soft to be a paediatrician. So when the kids got upset, it made me upset as well. So I did the job for a few months when I was sort of newly qualified.
Yeah.
And on one level, I really enjoyed it, but also I realized that I was going to struggle doing that.
Yeah.
It's much easier kind of doing the nasty things like sticking needles in adults than it is with kids. Then I was doing kind of medical specialities, and you kind of look at what you're good at and what you're interested in. And what I liked doing was spending time with people, building relationships with people, and sort of problem solving as well. One of my friends described doing diabetes and endocrinology being like doing crosswords at times, and I used to like doing crosswords. So it was kind of a bit of that, but then it was also the people that worked in, so you know, kind of something I said earlier on, it people that worked in diabetes, so my bosses and people that I work with, and also the people I met with diabetes, he taught me a lot about it.
Yeah. So did you know a lot about diabetes then before you obviously went to do your studying from 1991, or was it things that you learned over time? Did you have any connections to diabetes with people in your family or friends or someone you know who has a type of diabetes, or like I say, was it something that during your studies then you obviously started learning more and more about it?
Yeah, I think it wasn't something I really knew about. So, you know, in my very dim and distant past when I was at college, I played rugby a bit to a very, very low standard. It's quite hard to explain how low a standard it was, but some of the guys I played with who were much better than me at the time were living with type 1. And it was something that I have to say, with hindsight, I probably didn't take enough interest in them and what it actually meant for them at the time. It's obviously something I think about with hindsight. So that's probably where I first came across it. That was where it first kind of, I became aware of people that I was with who yeah. live with diabetes. But yeah, it was more actually one of my bosses at the time when I kind of was really choosing careers was a great, he was a great kind of diabetologist, but he lived with diabetes himself. And so, again, talking to him and learning from him and getting his insight was really invaluable.
Yeah.
So I guess a lot of the time it's been about the people.
Absolutely. So what about your sort of career now then? Or I guess after you then, obviously, you went through all your degrees and you did your Bachelor of Medicine in London. What sort of roles were you involved in then when you were no longer studying? What sort of jobs were you? Where were you?
Yeah. So I did my first year's work in London, and then so that's when I did the paediatric work, and worked at the Royal London, which was definitely an experience in Whitechapel. Then moved out of London, so I'd met my now wife then, and she was already, because I was a latecomer, she was already a qualified GP in Buckinghamshire, which is where we live now.
Yeah.
And she says when I first qualified, she was doing the same job that she is now, although she's doing it differently, and I'm sure she's doing it amazingly. I suspect it's not the same job in any way.
It's evolved.
So, yeah, moved out this way. Then when I was... worked in Northwest London when I was doing my more junior training, and then when I became a registrar, so I started my proper diabetes training. A job came up in the Oxford region, and I can remember that I went along to the interview. I was working in an intensive care unit at the time, and I was working nights, so I worked a night shift and then slept for a couple of hours and then went to the interview, and everyone seemed so much more experienced than me. And then I went home again and went back to bed, and then got a phone call, woke me up. I was really confused. And they told me that I'd sort of got the job.
Yeah.
I just couldn't believe it for a little while, because I'd just woken up. But yeah, I think there were other people who had more experience than me, but they took a risk on me, took a punt on me, and decided that they could teach me and they could train me, and they hopefully did a good job.
Yeah, definitely a good risk indeed. So what's your sort of day-to-day life now? So obviously, we mentioned in the introduction, you're obviously a diabetes consultant. What does your role at Oxford entail on a sort of day-to-day basis? Because I know we mentioned that you do different sort of roles, but I'll let you go into it, really.
Okay, yeah. So there's probably a few different things. So sort of probably worth talking about the kind of clinical work first, because that's, I guess, in some ways, the most important thing. So I do part of my job. I'm doing a bit less of this now, because I'm sort of focusing more on diabetes, because I think that's where I can kind of make the most difference for the biggest number of people.
Mm-hmm.
But I do also do kind of general ward work. So when you get admitted to hospital and you're unwell, and you go under a general physician, under the care of a general physician, then I do that work. So seeing all kinds of different people, sometimes young people with maybe one or two things wrong with them that we can hopefully fix quite quickly. And then sometimes it's older people with more complex sort of problems and more complex needs, and
yeah,
working about getting, you know, how we can support them and get them back home and things like that. So that's really, really interesting. On the diabetes side, I'm really interested in inpatient diabetes. It's not a massive part of my job, but in terms of certainly what I'm paid for, but it's something that I care about. So there's lots of different things. So it can be, we have a great diabetes nursing team, and so it's chatting with them and trying to sort of help them learn, help them, give them advice, talk through issues with them, see if we can find a solution together. Some of it's interesting. It's about trying to kind of get the right education out there to people. So we're training all of the staff who aren't specialists and kind of working out what's the best thing for them. It's about designing the right guidelines. So you may have heard of this, but there's a group called the JBDS, the Joint British Diabetes Societies, and they have an inpatient group that write a lot of fantastic guidelines. And so it's working those into, you know, it's how we look after people when they maybe come into hospital with a hypo, or have a hypo in hospital when they, if they come into hospital with DKA and all the rest of it, how we can best look after people. And so it's making sure that those guidelines are there, that people know about them, they know what to do, they know where to go if they have trouble. There's what else do we do? And the other thing is kind of trying to design the safety system. So, you know, we have electronic prescribing, so trying to make that as safe as possible, work out ways that we can stop people making mistakes. And also looking at it and kind of investigating when we don't get it right.
What you could do next time.
Yeah, making sure that we learn. And I think learning is the really important part. You know, we're never going to be perfect all the time, but if you want to try and make sure that the organization learns, but also make sure that there's systems where people can learn, so that we don't do the same things over and over again, which are not what people with diabetes need us to be doing. So yeah, so that's all fun. And then actually it's sometimes seeing people on the wards. Then there's so the transplant work, which I really enjoy, which is seeing people who might need a transplant. And I don't know if people in the group know people who've had transplants or perhaps have had transplants themselves. But there's a lot of assessment that goes on beforehand. So if we're doing just an islet transplant or just a whole pancreas transplant, those are things that people normally have if they're having real problems with severe hypos that are, you know, that where they're needing help dealing with them. And so that's we try and transplants, if you have a transplant, then you need to take immunosuppression tablets afterwards, so immune suppressants. And they're okay. There are millions of people taking them worldwide, but they do have risks. They do have side effects. So the first thing we try and do is see if we can help people with hypos without a transplant, but we also kind of get them prepared, make sure they've got all the information and kind of get them onto the waiting list where it's appropriate. And then some people have kidney problems and need a renal transplant. And certainly if you have type 1 diabetes, if they're going to do a kidney transplant, they'll possibly try and do a pancreas transplant at the same time, although that is a big operation. And so sometimes if they worry about that being too much, then they might look at maybe doing an islet transplant at the same time. So meet lots of people.
Wow.
That way, and it's really, really interesting work. And then sometimes it's looking after the people after the transplants as well.
Yeah.
So one of the things I've done today is go and see someone on the ward who's had something really interesting done, which might sound quite strange to this group. I had something called a total pancreatectomy and islet auto transplant. So this is someone who's had their pancreas taken out because of ongoing real horrible pain and problems from pancreatic inflammation, so yeah, pancreatitis and chronic pancreatitis. And it sometimes does get to the stage where removing the pancreas is the best thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, you know, you guys all know that that then means if you haven't got a pancreas, then you haven't got a way of making insulin. Now, we do what we tell people is to kind of expect to have diabetes that's a bit like type 1 afterwards. But and people will choose, this is the level of pain they're in, people will choose to do that. But we also, so our incredible islet lab will take someone's pancreas and do what they do for a normal islet transplant and kind of break it down in the lab and break it down, say mechanically and using enzymes as well, and then try and extract the islets from them. So what we can do, if we can get islets out, we can then give those back to the person, which at least can help with the diabetes that people have afterwards. And occasionally it means that people, even though they've had their pancreas removed, don't need any insulin treatment. That's pretty rare, but it does happen.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating, Alistair. It's just great to hear your incredible list of jobs there. I guess your schedule must be like full, like every like color coordinated, knowing what you're doing next. But I think it's great that you've just got a varied role there, that you could be in a consultancy sort of appointment, or you might be in an inpatient ward, or you may be talking to colleagues and helping them educate them and look at strategies or look at systems. Like, it's just it's really impressive, and it's great and that you're able to share that with us. What would you say you love about your job the most, or what are the challenges do you face?
What I love about the job is still the people. I mean, people with diabetes, so, you know, there's people I've known. I've been in my current job. I only worked this out recently. I've been in my current job over 10 years. So there's people I've known for 10 years because of my current job. And that's colleagues, but it's also people with diabetes. And yeah, both of those groups are actually really important to me. Because I think we're in a very privileged position in some way working in diabetes, because a lot of the time we're in medicine, you're with someone who is, you know, in some way sort of has a reversible illness. And so you kind of identify the reversible illness, you treat it, and then it goes away, and then that's it. You know, you'll never see them again. Now, mm-hmm. Hopefully you've done a good job while you do that. And working with diabetes, it's a condition that people live with. I often say with this sport and exercise work, it's really interesting. You know, there's the, and I know there are different views about this, but there's the word patient that's sometimes used. But I'm working with people with a condition who are often much kind of fitter and healthier than I am. I'm the least healthy person in the room, is what I often think when I'm doing the sports clinics. That I think is really interesting.
Yeah, and I guess that just shows, isn't it, that anyone can get diabetes of any age, any sort of condition, you know what I mean? There's not like one set way of, or something you did, or, and we're talking, I guess, about type 1 now, you know what I mean? It can happen to anyone. And that's why we talk about, and so many people raise the awareness, isn't it, of the symptoms of diabetes and keeping a watchful eye, because it can be dangerous, can't it?
Yeah, I think it's really important, and getting that message out there is really important. And one of the things I do when we meet new people, and you know, it's not special to me, it's something that I know a lot of my colleagues do, is sort of ask about the time when people are diagnosed, and that's a massive it's a massively important time. And I think there's probably a couple of things about it. One is, you know, we've got to work hard, and again, this is something we're constantly looking at, constantly. You know, I don't think there's one right way to deal with time around diagnosis for everybody, but seeing how we can do things better. And I think, you know, if we can hopefully offer people the right information and the right support around diagnosis, it's never going to make it easy, But what it does is kind of make it manageable for people. I think one of the things that's really important for us to do is point people towards peer support. I think diabetes is one of those things where the expertise, I don't think, lies in us as clinicians. I think the expertise lies in the whole community of people with diabetes, and I think we can, as clinicians, can have something to offer to that. But we have a particular type of expertise, but there's a lot of expertise, you know, out there in the community, which is above and beyond what we can offer. And I think that's you know, kind of really, really important. We're seeing, you know, we're seeing more and more how important that is. And I think just a very quick point, sorry.
Go on.
I think we also sometimes see where we haven't got it right in the past, and how that's impacted people. And then sometimes, you know, you're wanting to try and help people, you know, understand with diabetes and work out ways of living with diabetes, but the way they were spoken to at the beginning was really unhelpful.
Mm-hmm.
And has really, you know, set up some barriers for helping those people, you know, with self-management, which you all know is what living with diabetes entails.
Absolutely. It was 180 decisions that we're making on top of everything else that the second we get out of bed, it's really, really challenging, isn't it? And I think that'll lead us on to our next section, really talking about technology and the impacts of technology, that hopefully positive impacts of technology. So obviously, your role as well. So you are the co-chair of the DTN UK group. Would you share with us what is the DTN UK group? What is the network? What sort of things have you been involved in, or what have the network been involved in?
Great. So DTN UK started off, so Emma Wilmot is entirely responsible, I've got to say. So Emma is the person who brought this into being. And Emma got together, essentially, it started off when we didn't really have much in the way of CGM around, but we had access to insulin pumps. And there were enthusiastic people around the country. And learn from each other. And so the insulin pump network was born. And Emma said she organized it so that someone else would chair it. I won't say who, but that person was very insightful and said, "No, Emma, this should be your group and you should chair it." So it started off as to get together to share kind of what we were doing, you know, where people were doing things well, so we could all learn from it and also share our problems and share our challenges. And there was a committee, and then the committee organized
sort of national meetings so that you could spread the word about insulin pumps more widely. And this was back when there were some centers who really wouldn't have anybody using insulin pumps at all. So, and that it's kind of grown from there. So it's an organization now. It's obviously expanded to diabetes technology. So pumps and CGM and hybrid closed loop and kind of anything else. That we are a healthcare professional organization, but we see an important role in how we interact with people with diabetes as well. Because one of the ways we can help other healthcare professionals is by putting information out there. So information that people with diabetes can use as well as healthcare professionals. So we've got lots of videos and other things available. If you go onto our website, which is ABCD, which is the Association of British Clinical Diabetologists, you can see that's been profiled in. ABCD and then DTN, and that will take you to our website. So all of our stuff is freely available.
Great, great. Nice little plug there. And also, you talked about, obviously, you as healthcare professionals who are the sort of leading experts in the sort of diabetes field, but you also talked about the person, the people living with diabetes. And I guess also we could talk about the diabetes F people, that like friends and family, because they're also, I guess, experts as well in their own way. But I did have a glance on the website, and there is obviously part of the committee, and I know Sean is listening in right now, and it's great that there's actually people on the actual committee representing the lived experience of diabetes alongside you guys who in your amazing roles, right?
Well, I think it's really important,
yeah.
You know, and hopefully Sean understands that we absolutely value him. So there's Sean and Tim and Hannah who've joined the committee, yep, this year. We've got just incredibly talented people who can come along. And I think, you know, we can come up with ideas, but our ideas get, sense checked. So there can be things that we think are important that actually are less important. So our focus can be, can be taken off those and pointed towards the stuff that we should be focusing on.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, at the moment there are things, the hybrid closed loop is obviously massively in the news. So that's our big focus at the moment. But there are other things that we need to make sure we're not forgetting, and that our committee members with diabetes, and actually, I've got to say, we've got an incredibly talented committee of healthcare professionals. I really do sometimes look around the room and think, why am I in the chair? But my job is not to know everything. It's to harness the incredible expertise we've got available.
That's incredible.
Hopefully I can do that.
Yeah, and it's just great to have pioneers, people, great advocates, like you're obviously a specialist in your right, but it's great to people who are really fighting for the best care for people. So what sort of technology research or things have either DTN UK have been part of, or what other things or what research things have you been part of that are focused on technology, and what sort of things are coming out from that research in terms of the benefits maybe, or are there any sort of drawbacks? What sort of findings are you guys finding?
So we've kind of got three different roles that we do. And so one of our roles is education. So we try and produce a lot of resources for people with diabetes and also for healthcare professionals. So there's a whole load of resources and guidelines and things like that that we produce. So education, guidelines, and the other thing that we try and do is work with people like Partha in NHS England. Partha's been an incredible leader in terms of improving access to diabetes technology and really doing what we can to sit behind that and maybe provide some of the evidence. So one of the big things, and Partha organised this and arranged the funding from NHS England, so it wouldn't have happened without him, and then was the hybrid closed loop pilot. So we tried to get as many people as possible onto hybrid closed loop that met very specific criteria, and those were already using an insulin pump and a Freestyle Libre and had an HbA1c of 69 or over, or 8.5% or over, depending on which HbA1c language you speak. And so we went around our centres, tried to get as many people as possible. We're aiming for 1,000. I think we got to about 5,080. But got those people on, got all the funding sorted out, and got people onto the systems within about 6 months of this first being suggested. And then what we did was really collect some what we called audit data, and it was very sort of very careful that it wasn't a study, because this was something that could be routine clinical care. So we just collected stuff that would be in routine clinical care, ideally. And that was sort of information about impact on blood glucose, But also impact on things like hyper, so it might be time in range, might be HbA1c, both of which improved significantly. So time in range went from 34 to 62%, I think. No increase in hypos. HbA1c dropped by sort of 1.5% for those people. But what we also saw was far fewer people experiencing diabetes distress. Mm-hmm. So I've got there's a couple of concepts that I've been introduced to. You know, one is the obvious concept of time in range, but then the other concept is time in happiness.
Yeah.
And time in range and time in happiness are not always the same thing. And I think for us as healthcare professionals, that's really important for us to remember. So increasing time in range, but with a lot of effort and a lot of stress and things like that, doesn't always equate to an increase in time in happiness, and the two need to be taken into account. But what we've seen is these systems, because they take you, and you talked about the decision making earlier on, Tom, because the systems take some of the decision making, that pressure off of people, and actually relieve some of that burden that people describe so beautifully, that actually increased time in range for a lot of people did also result in an increase in time in happiness, so measured by a reduction in distress and improvements in kind of quality of life measures. So that was really important to see.
And I guess as well, these sort of studies will, and the benefits of this amazing technology now, and with the new TA hopefully coming through in this month, really, I guess over time we'll see hopefully the bigger picture of the impact of this amazing technology, but also see hopefully reducing sort of admissions into hospitals, potential complications or illnesses. I guess that's another sort of area of doing this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, diabetes can be a difficult condition to live with. And if you see that there's a lot of people who don't end up in hospital at all, but who are still, you know, having to work hard to maintain diabetes management. And that's, a lot of those were the group of people that were in that pilot group. Yeah. But there's some people who really struggle with their diabetes, and part of their struggle means that they're often admitted to hospital, and actually something we can offer that reduces those kind of things, which is a massive relief of burden for them. You know, that's really important, but also giving people a tool. And in the end, you know, all we as healthcare professionals can do, we're not managing the condition for people. People are managing the condition for themselves. And what we're trying to do is put the right tools in place to help people to do that. And I think, you know, this just shows itself as a tool that really allows more and more people to hit targets that they want to hit without it placing a huge burden on them. So, you know, the idea that we're potentially going to be able to increase access to hybrid closed loop is just so exciting.
Yeah. And like you say, Alistair, I think it's great, the study and seeing now hopefully this come into fruition. And obviously the pilot saw improvements of HbA1c, time in range, hypoglycemia awareness, things like that. Like you said, the diabetes-related distress, quality of life. But also, like you say, the mental health aspect of living with diabetes, it is so hard. And like you said, refer back to them so many decisions a day. And hopefully this technology, it's a game changer. It's life changing. Brilliant stuff. Thank you so much for everything that you and the committee and everyone part of it, rolling it out and getting it out there. And now hopefully we'll see this month, hopefully it come into fruition. So great stuff. Let's move on to our next sort of piece. And then we've got some questions from the community. sports and exercise. I think for definite, I think we could definitely link up again and do a bigger piece on this, because I think tonight, guys, we've literally touching the surface of things, which is really nice to kind of get a picture of who Alistair is and all the amazing things that he's doing. But I think we should definitely come back and do a future chat on more detailed sports and exercise. But what sort of what interests you about sports and exercise in the world of diabetes care? What sort of things that have you been part of, or what things interest you? And I know we mentioned in the introduction about X-Tod. So I don't know if you wanted to tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I was incredibly lucky. I sort of totally ended up by accident working in sport and exercise in type 1, because as I sort of mentioned, my own sporting talent is impressively limited, but I'm a sports fan, and I went to work with a chap called Ian Gallen, Dr. Ian Gallen at Wickham Hospital, as the second job as part of my training. And some of you may have come across Ian Gallen in the past, but he was the chap who looked after Sir Steve Redgrave after he developed diabetes and before he won his fifth Olympic medal. And at that point, which is sort of back in the mid-2000s, really, people with diabetes would often be told not to do exercise or to limit what exercise they did. Now, obviously, you know, people with diabetes are people, and if they wanted to go out and play sport and exercise, then that's what they do. But they weren't getting particularly good advice or support with doing it. And Ian was absolutely at the vanguard of changing that. One of the first people I saw was someone who was planning to row across the Atlantic. Which was, you know, I get to meet such amazing people, and that was fascinating. So I think, you know, we've seen in the JDRF have actually done a piece of work recently that again shows that this is an area where people with diabetes want more support than they're getting. Mm-hmm. And so the idea behind X-Tod and the people behind X-Tod really are Rob Andrews from Exeter and Taunton, and Parth Narendran from Birmingham. So those are the real, both professors, and those are the real driving force behind X-Tod. But it's providing, the thinking behind it is providing information and education to healthcare professionals so that they can support people with diabetes and try and fill that gap that people with diabetes are obviously finding. And there's also some direct meetings and so they've got an X-Tod course that they've designed that people, some centres are using to sort of support people with diabetes who are doing sport and exercise, and particularly who are building up to an event. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of you could think of that as a kind of Daphne for sport and exercise.
Yeah.
But another, I'm going to put in another shameless plug as well.
Go for it.
Also on the 11th of November, there's an event for people with diabetes which is an X-Tod day for people with diabetes, which again is about sort of building on that course that's been designed, and again getting people together to share information around sport and exercise and diabetes, and also to allow people, you know, in the room to share that together. I don't know if any of you ever went on one of the Animas sports weekends, which are one of the most fun things I've ever done. Which is getting 50 people with type 1 together in Loughborough and sort of giving them information about managing diabetes for sport and exercise, and also going out and doing some exercise as well. And those things were absolutely fantastic. And I can remember talking to Ian about it, that actually we could give people a certain amount of information from within the room, from the front of the room, but most of the learning and most of the expertise sat in that room.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic watching it. You know, getting 50 people with type 1 in a room together was amazing in itself, because I think then there's automatically a shorthand. People don't have to kind of, you know, explain what type 1 is and what they're doing and all the rest of it, because everyone else just knows.
Just gets it.
And just gets it. And that was powerful in itself. But watching, you know, after a few hours, then, you know, Ian and I might as well not have been there.
It comes back to, doesn't it? It's just that sort of balance and that relationship between the healthcare professionals and us guys who have diabetes or have connections to diabetes. It might be a family member, and I think they go in each other's like way. You know what I mean? You have to have both, and I think we've seen over the last 5 years or so that the impact of how big peer support is, especially online on different groups and Facebook and whatnot. And I know Partha says, is it something like we see our healthcare professional for like something like 2% of the time a year, and some people may not even see their healthcare professional since COVID. But having a support network to like ask questions or just learn or see how they coach. But guys, please go check out Xtod. Their website, I believe, is xtod.org, and you'll see loads of awesome stuff and research and programs. And is the tickets available for this event on World Diabetes Weekend?
I believe there still are. I believe there are still tickets available. What I will do, there were last time I asked, but what I'll do is after this chat this evening, Tom, I can share the details with you.
Please do.
I can tweet them out, but I'm sure if you do, it will reach far more people.
We'll get it out,
just so that, you know, if people are interested.
Yeah. And anyone else also interested, we've had some exercise and sport chats on diabetes chat. So get over to the website, diabeteschat.net. And like Alistair said, we have had Path and Rob and Nusrat as well. So we had a nutritious sort of aspect of it as well. So, and we did four episodes actually. So go check them out, and we'll post about them again. So we have some questions for you from the community. About sports and exercise. So Gillian, who's listening in, she says, have there been any studies looking at how BG sensor readings are impacted by exercise of muscles close to where the sensor is located?
Okay. So there is a bit of research in this area. So what we know with exercise is that there are sort of various things that will affect the accuracy of sensors, or can potentially affect the accuracy of sensors. And so some of that is changes in blood flow. There might be changes in kind of how acid the environment is. Dehydration can have an impact, and that obviously also has an effect on, is something that happens a lot in the context of exercise and physical activity, or it can be easy to get dehydrated. And also, you know, things like the actual site of a sensor. So depending on where all of those factors can be affected differently depending how it relates to an exercising muscle. So I think one of the things I would say with the sensors is that they're actually often remarkably accurate during activity. Now, obviously, with the usual caveats that actually when glucose is changing quickly, there is going to be a lag between blood glucose and sensor glucose. And if you're not sure, then the most accurate thing is always to check a finger prick.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that, Gillian. Hope that answered your question there. Please come back to us if not, or jump on and we can further go down the avenue. Judith says, I'd like to ask Alistair about early morning exercise with no food on board and a very small bolus for foot to floor. I only lane swim for half an hour. I'm usually okay. But after lane swimming, I usually go high. Is this because of the activity before breakfast?
Okay, that's a really good question. So actually, there's something about being active in a properly fasted state, and we usually see that first thing in the morning. It's where the body, because all the hormones that wake, you know, kind of help the body wake up in the morning, we're understanding more and more that the you know, our bodies have a 24-hour rhythm, that things don't stay steady throughout the day. And all of the hormones that help you wake up in the morning are things like your natural steroid cortisol and things like that. All those rise in the morning. So that first thing in the morning, and as you say, before breakfast, is actually where people are going to be at their most resistant to insulin comparatively compared to the whole day. So what that means is actually doing even aerobic activity at that type of day, and that's, so aerobic activity is normally kind of that kind of moderate intensity where you could keep it going for a period of kind of half an hour to an hour, which often will make blood glucose drop later in the day, actually in the fasted state often doesn't have as much of an impact. The rising afterwards is really interesting, and I think that's potentially down to, you know, from a purely exercise point of view, could potentially be down to one of two things. So one is one of the way the body changes, it changes levels of things like cortisol and growth hormone and adrenaline in response to exercise, which means that the body starts producing more fuel from its stores, and that might be fat as fuel, or it might be glucose as fuel, but producing more fuel from its stores. And actually those hormones don't go back to normal, you know, when you climb out the pool. So they get to that level while you're swimming, but when you climb out the pool and stop exercising, those hormones take about half an hour to go back to normal. And so that's why you often see a sort of tick up in blood glucose after activity. And we're seeing that more now that people have CGM.
Yes.
More people have CGM. We see that tick up after activity. The other thing that can do it, and it's one of the things that people are often kind of most relieved to hear or most surprised by, is if some of the activity hits that kind of really high intensity where you're really building. Yeah, really interesting question. Oh, Tom, I can't hear you. Yes. Yeah. And actually an hour to an hour and a half in advance is what the evidence says. So for the closed loop, that means turning on the exercise mode or the ease off mode or whatever it's called, the kind of which will deliver less insulin. So ideally you turn that on in advance, and about an hour, hour and a half in advance, And the other thing is, the other thing for that kind of activity, because that kind of activity, as you all know, is often associated with blood glucose dropping. So the other thing is taking in a bit of extra carbohydrate. Now, the sort of advantage of having a closed loop system is you definitely have some CGM there, so you can track what's happening with blood glucose. And the important thing is that you don't want to over replace, because if you take on too much fast, it's little bits of fast acting carbohydrate, sort of every 15, 20 minutes, are probably the ideal thing to keep the glucose in a range. And you're probably looking at, for an hour of activity, maybe a quarter to a half grams of carbohydrate per kilo of body weight for an hour of exercise, which sounds quite complicated. So what that means is, for someone who weighs 60 kilos, that's between 15 and 30 grams of carbs over an hour. But be guarded by what's happening with the sensor, because if the glucose is going up too far, then the system will start delivering insulin. And that's obviously not helpful. And if the glucose, you know, you may, if the glucose is dropping, then you might need to just speed that up.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously, hopefully when hybrid closed loop comes a thing, when the TA hopefully gets approved this month, will over time there'll be clinics like across the country supporting people? Do you think there'll be like workshops, or do you think there will be people who'll be able to help people with exercise and sports? Because I guess it's, there's going to be so many avenues coming out of hybrid closed looping, I guess, but I guess one of them will be sports and exercise, right?
Yeah, and I think it's probably going to be, so we'll use the same kind of, probably if we're looking at sport and exercise, so rolling it out, we've got some centres who've got more expertise at the moment with hybrid closed loop and some that have less expertise with hybrid closed loop. And what we'll, I suspect we'll see is that the centres with more experience will be doing more to start off with. And over time, I think every, I think healthcare professionals across the whole country have seen the benefit of hybrid closed loop for people with diabetes. So I think, honestly, everyone wants to be a part of it.
Yeah.
But people are going to come to it at different speeds. I think if we're talking specifically about sport and exercise, and I think it'll probably be, you know, almost the same, if we look at, think about it as a model, almost the same model that we're using at the moment, in that there'll be hopefully some training and education for all healthcare professionals, so they can give kind of the most basic advice that we'll try and, you know, from a DTM point of view, mm-hmm. There is, if there isn't already, there's going to be very soon a video on the DTM website specifically talking about this. I'm afraid it's my droning voice again. But say we'll try and provide training for people, and there will always be specialist sort of centres across the country where there are people who have got a real interest in this.
Yes.
And I know, you know, Rob sees people, I see people, Path sees people, and there are also other people, so Simon Saunders in Liverpool, and on the world there's Paddy English down in Devon, I think. So there's people all across the country who have an interest and an expertise, who will usually be, you know, providing the maybe more specialised advice.
And I think social media plays a big part to this as well, because I think things are more accessible. People see things more clearer. It's visual. They can see it there rather than potentially waiting till your next appointment and, oh, what's that? I've never heard about that. So right now there's lots of benefits of social media, and it's great to have amazing people like you, Alistair, and the, all the amazing healthcare professionals that we know. And it's great that you guys like connect with communities and reach out and help, and you know what I mean, if anyone I'm sure has any questions, like reach out to Alistair, send them in a post, or Path or Rob or any amazing healthcare professional or us guys, and we'll link you guys to these people.
There's so much expertise in the community. Yeah. It's brilliant. Often I see the best advice has been given before I get anywhere near it, and it's from people with better first-person knowledge.
First-person knowledge, yeah.
Which is better than mine.
Nikki says, not exercise-related question, sorry, Alistair. Are you aware of more tech options becoming available in the near future for hybrid closed loop in pregnancy? If someone is on a system that's unlicensed for pregnancy, will they have to change to a different tech if pregnant?
That's a really insightful question. So I think the system step indication in pregnancy.
Oh, 1 second. Claire?
I'm not that musical, unfortunately.
I thought you were going to do the live song then, Alistair.
Yeah. So the system basically gets an opportunity to be used in pregnancy or an indication in pregnancy by having done the studies. So the system that has done the studies is the CAM-APS, and other systems are undergoing trials in pregnancy at the moment. So I think the other systems will potentially become available in pregnancy too. I think in terms of if someone's using a system successfully, then I think you'll probably find that most people will have a conversation with the person with diabetes, with a woman with diabetes, and will come to a joint decision about whether to continue using the system. I think if you're using a system successfully and it's achieving the targets that you want to achieve, then just coming off it for the sake of it and just because it's not formally indicated in pregnancy, I don't think is helpful for people. Mm-hmm. What the CAM-APS system does have is a lot of flexibility around targets. And what that means is it's the one that's really well set up to hit the more the tighter glucose targets, which are recommended in pregnancy because they're associated with the best outcomes. I think the other systems will be looking at ways in which they can adapt as well in order to do that. But in the end, it's finding the thing that works best for the woman. And if that's a system which isn't formally licensed in pregnancy, then I think that's a discussion about continuing. And as long as everyone knows what they're doing, then I think there's nothing that says that's the wrong thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, brilliant. Great question, Nikki. And thank you, Alistair, for that. Before we finish, Dan, let's round up tonight's chat. And just two or three last questions, talking about mental health, which we have talked about tonight a little bit. Mm. What does mental health mean to you, Alistair, and what do you do to improve your mental health?
So what does mental health mean to me? I that's a really, really interesting question. And I think it means being able to function within my family and within my responsibilities and within the world in which I live. And by function, I mean functioning within the family, I think means sometimes bringing some happiness. Not always, you can ask my children. I definitely don't always bring happiness. But sometimes being able to bring some happiness as part of that. And I think, what do I do to improve my mental health? I think it's spending time with family and friends. I think it's really important. I find getting out in the country, the dogs are absolutely amazing. So I came home from work tonight, got back quite late, busy day, just sat and got cuddled by two dogs for 5 minutes. And that definitely I would recommend. Activity, being out in the countryside around here, so just walking with the dogs around where I live, so I live in the Chiltern Hills, is lovely. And I love getting out and being out, so getting out on the mountain bike, getting out on the bike.
Yeah,
I've not for various reasons not been able to run recently, but
I guess it's like
doing all of that is what works for me.
Finding that time to go maybe switch off from the busy world that we all live in and the pressures of life and work and things. And if you can find something that you're really interested in, that hopefully can boost your sort of mental health status. Stephen says, good to hear tonight's call. will be interested when I get back on the mountain bike after last week's pump start, aiming to do at least one lap as part of a quad at the Strathpuffer 24 mountain bike race. Is that something you're interested in, Alistair, as a fellow mountain biker?
It sounds really interesting. I've worked with people who've done 24-hour mountain bike races before, so and actually pumps have been quite helpful for that. So that's really, that's really interesting. Actually doing one of the races, do you know what? Yeah, that does sound quite interesting, although I think my mountain bike skills are like my skills in most sports. I'm much more limited than most of the people I work with.
Okay, last couple of questions. What's your thoughts on peer support, and what would you say are the sort of fundamental factors of connecting with people, like maybe in general, but in terms of the diabetes world, what are the main benefits of connecting with people, would you say?
I think peer support is so important, and I think it's that. For me, as an outsider, what I see that peer support brings is that people who just get it, who don't need you to explain things to them, who just get where it comes from. And I think that's really important. And the kind of understanding of stigma, the lack of judgment, and the recognition that actually you can be working really hard and you're not getting the results you want. And that's not because of what you're doing. It's just because it's hard. And I think peer support, I think hopefully helps people to and it's it can sound a trite phrase, but to, you know, what I would say is not be hard on themselves. But the other thing, the other way of putting that is be kind to themselves. And I think, I think that the incredible approach, I watch peer support online from people with diabetes, and the way that it self-moderates, that there's a lot of, you know, people understand that their experience is the experience of one person, and that there are different ways of doing things. The kind of your diabetes may vary. I find the peer support really impressive for that reason, that people will share, but they won't advise. Now, I think it's just really fantastic, really fascinating the way it works, and really fantastic, and creating large groups of people, which is what's happened online, and it's what you do, Tom, you know, with this kind of fantastic chat, allows people to get perspectives from so many different people.
Yeah.
And they can then add that together and make it their own, which is really powerful.
No, that's great, isn't it? And last question for me really is, what are your hopes and aspirations, not only for yourself, I guess, but also sort of diabetes care and management? What's your hopes and aspirations for the future? Big question to finish.
Yeah. Well, I guess my aspiration, my hope and aspiration in a sense, is to not be in a job. Because, you know, if there are things out there that, you know, that there's exciting stuff going on, you know, that people don't need people like me. Actually, that in the end would be a fantastic result. I think I'm far enough through my career now to say that would be a fantastic result. I know it's been promised to everybody that it's coming in 10 years. For the last 100 years since the discovery of insulin, I think we are getting closer to that world. So the immunotherapies, which are at least delaying people's onset of diabetes, the trials where people are being screened so you can catch diabetes so early that those immunotherapies can work. So, you know, one of the things that we're doing at the moment, we're about to start taking part in a trial of stem cell islet transplantation. So the potential to have sources of, you know, islets which aren't independent of the number of donors that you have, and offer another way